Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Many people are still celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday, and on this most American of holidays, there's been a lot of talk this year about refuge and refugees, in particular Syrian refugees. And this topic is going to kick off our week in review conversation today. On Sunday, Governor Charlie Baker softened his position on Syrian refugees coming to Massachusetts.
Look, Massachusetts has a long and storied history as an engaged and active participant in refugee resettlement, and I believe in that and I support it. My issue is I'm just looking for some answers from the federal government, which we're currently engaged in what I'm hoping is going to be a productive and serious debate about some of the issues that people have raised on both sides about the vetting process.
Baker did not join 27 Republican governors who sent a letter to President Obama asking the president to suspend the government's Syrian refugee resettlement program. Baker did say he wants to know more about how Syrian refugees might be vetted, and he's concerned about security issues. But Congressman Seth Moulton says those concerns are unfounded.
I think law enforcement realizes that what ISIS is trying to do is not just send terrorists overseas, but radicalize people right here at home. And if we say that American values don't apply to certain religions or certain nationalities, then that just hands a propaganda victory to ISIS.
Joining us in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll. He's a professor of communication at Boston University and a WBUR senior news analyst. Hello, John.
Hello, Deb.
Also with us is Dante Ramos. He's an op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Dante.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay. Good to have you. Well, both of you, I want to ask both of you this question about this continuing debate about refugees and refugee resettlement. Just today, one of the GOP candidates for governor in Vermont changed his position after learning more about the screening process for refugees. And I'm wondering if you think, John, let's start with you. Do you think after hearing about all of this that folks are going to change their mind? Does it even make a difference?
Well, it certainly makes a difference. I don't know if they're going to change their minds or not. I mean, you have parallel universes operating here. One is the GOP presidential field, which is basically just trying to out-tough each other in terms of how much restriction of a restriction they can put on Syrian refugees. On the other hand, you have people like Charlie Baker, who is being painted as somebody who's been sort of flopping around like a sea bass here, but he's been really reasonably consistent. In September, he said, I'm open to talking about it. Two weeks ago, he said, no, not right now, not until I get some answers. Now he says, we have a role in welcoming refugees. I mean, it's all pretty much the same position that he's had, which has been a moderate position. So,
but a bit softened. He's definitely softened.
A little bit, because I think the PR, I think the media coverage actually was kind of unfair a couple of weeks ago when he said, no, not right now, not until I get some answers. So, I think he realizes that it's a more delicate situation here in Massachusetts. But a poll that just came out from Suffolk University says, you know, a plurality of Massachusetts residents are behind him in terms of being very cautious about accepting Syrian refugees.
Dante, your thoughts?
I think there's two discussions going on right now. One is whether or not there is a vetting process for Syrian refugees, and that is something that can be answered substantively and is being answered substantively. I think the administration, the Obama administration, initially may have underestimated the amount of explaining that they needed to do to the public on this. Subsequently, Secretary of State John Kerry and the Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson sent out a letter explaining to interested parties that there is a very close vetting of Syrian refugees, and that, you know, more so than anybody who comes into the country in a lot of ways. So if the objections are based upon people not having answers, they will get those answers and hopefully that will change opinions. The larger question, of course, and John alluded to this, is the kind of conflation of everyone from every Muslim country with, you know, the lack of knowledge about who might be a terrorist or a jihadist and who might not be. And, you know, I don't think in the Republican presidential field we're seeing much of a willingness to make fine distinctions. You know, you're seeing people lumping rather than splitting when the latter is really what ought to be done.
You know, we did speak with Sasha Chanoff. He's the co-founder and executive director of the group Refuge Point. And he talked with us about the whole vetting process. And he said it starts with humanitarian groups who work with refugees for years and then enter this vetting process. He says then the UN prepares a case file and then the process in the U.S. starts. Let's listen to him a little bit about how he explains it.
The first step is that there are three face-to-face interviews with a Department of State contractor where different people meet with the refugee in question. They collect data and their story of persecution and other information. And that's three separate interviews so that they can compare information. After that, the case is sent for U.S. government security clearances. These clearances since 9/11 have become extensive. This process can take many years.
So, John, let's start with you. Do you think there's an understanding that this is a very involved process? And is it enough to know that this process exists to satisfy people's concerns about security, particularly post-Paris?
No, I don't think there's an understanding, for one thing, but I don't think it matters either, because I think, you know, he's presenting a very rational, logical approach to how to feel about and how to view this process. But this is not a rational argument. This is an emotional argument. Mm. And this is something where governors are coming out saying, we're not going to accept refugees when the law says they don't have any choice in it. As soon as a refugee is legal in the United States, that person can go wherever he or she wants. So the governors are taking sort of a Potemkin stand here in terms of their resistance to it. And also this whole movement by Congress to try to cut off funding. The funding's already in place for 2016, so that's not going to work. The last thing is the numbers are incredibly small here. You have 4 million Syrians who have fled the country, and we're talking about taking in 10,000 tops.
We've taken in this whole country.
Right,
in this state, it's like 100.
We have 72 here in Massachusetts.
Right.
So we've taken in 2,100 refugees so far in the last 10 years, most in the last year. This is a really small segment of a huge problem that a lot of Americans have inflated far beyond the proportion that it deserves.
So, and Dante, I'm wondering what you think. Is this really an emotional debate? And it doesn't, you know, these concerns about the vetting process and these details about the vetting process may be secondary in a lot of people's minds.
I think to the extent that the details are secondary, it's that people's impressions of what the issues are, I think, are formed by, you know, somewhat inadequate impressions. We have seen all of the coverage of large numbers of people, you know, coming up on the beach in Greece or, you know, walking through border crossings in Balkan countries and in Eastern and Central Europe. And, you know, you get the impression that there's a large and uncontrolled mass movement of people. And, you know, what John was just describing is a very controlled movement into the United States. The situation here is much different from what is happening in Greece, but I don't think that that has necessarily reflected itself in coverage up to now. So, you know, hopefully as more information filters through, people will get a more accurate sense of what the issues are.
Mm-hmm. Do you also agree it's not that big of an issue here when you look at numbers?
I don't think it's a big issue in terms of numbers. I would also, I think one reason why all of this is happening is obviously, is an outgrowth of policy decisions made by the United States and other countries in Syria and in that region. And, you know, I would hope that people would not see us as being insulated from the consequences of the policy decisions that we've made over there.
As opposed to every other issue that we're insulated on, right?
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. It is the Thanksgiving weekend, as we mentioned, so lots of people will be heading to the movies because it's the holiday. And I want to talk about one movie that we've covered a lot on this show, and there's been a lot of discussion about this movie, and that is Spotlight. Obviously, this is important, very important locally. There are many folks here who have been victims of sexual abuse, have connections to victims, many church and Catholic officials here who have had to deal with the issues that are discussed and raised in this movie. And on top of that, we've had some real life people in Spotlight on our show. Boston Globe journalists Walter Robinson, Michael Resendez, clergy sex abuse survivor Phil Saviano, and lawyer Mitchell Garabedian. And for the most part, they all say they like the movie. But that is not the case for a couple of people who have been portrayed in the film. Jack Dunn, He appears in Spotlight. He's a PR person for Boston College, and in the movie, he's PR person for Boston College High School. He says the character in the film was completely wrong. That is not him, and he's actually seeking legal action against the filmmakers, calling for one scene to be removed. This is what Jack Dunn told WBZ earlier this week.
The words not only did I not say, but they represent the exact opposite of what I did, what I said, and how I feel as a human being.
Now, Dunn says the movie portrays him as being opposed to the Boston Globe's investigation of clergy abuse and as brushing off information that a priest at BC High was guilty of abuse. Now, in reality, Boston Globe writer Kevin Cullen says Dunn created a hotline at BC High for victims, and he hired an independent child advocate, and he worked with law enforcement. So I want to start with you, John. What is the danger here? You know, how do you walk a line like that in depicting a real-life person in a film, and you know, especially in an issue like this that's so controversial and is so much clearer in hindsight than it may have been at the time?
Absolutely. And it's difficult to navigate the intersection of fact and fiction in any circumstance. So in this one in particular, because it's such a fraught issue, it has even bigger implications. It would be curious that a movie where the producers and the actors are so obsessed with the smallest detail, getting the smallest detail right, you know, what kind of pen do you use, how many boxes were there piled around your desk, mm-hmm. would get such a big detail wrong.
Right.
But and there are conflicting stories here. So this is very much a he said, they said, because Jack Dunn said that didn't happen. He didn't say that in the meeting. Walter Robinson and Sasha Pfeiffer, who were in the meeting, have subsequently said that was the substance of the meeting. The interesting thing from a filmmaking standpoint is that this could have been put, these statements could have been put in the mouth of a fictional character who was in the room, who was in the scene, mm-hmm. Who I'm not sure was in the actual meeting. But it wasn't. It was initially in an early scene, then it was transferred to Jack Dunn. So his complaint is that why would you have a real-life person say something he didn't say when you've got a fictional character that you could easily hand it off to? So that's one issue. But we don't really know. And Jack Dunn says, look at the stories that came out in March of 2002, subsequent to the meeting. There's nothing in there that indicates that this happened. Mm-hmm. And that's true. But there's no saying that that would have wound up in any article, a conversation like that.
Right.
I mean, it was a very detailed and very limited kind of coverage. And the next day, the second day of the coverage, Jack Dunn did come out and say, we set up a victim's hotline, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really hard to know. But I think the filmmakers, if they had any doubt, I think they had a better alternative than to have Jack Dunn say that if indeed he did not say it.
Mm-hmm. Dante Ramos.
I should say too. I work at the Globe and know some of the folks. Work mm-hmm. with some of the folks who are portrayed in the movie. I didn't arrive there until long after the events portrayed in the film were there, and can't have no particular insights into what happened at that meeting. I suspect that the filmmakers probably wish they had put the scene together a little bit differently. I was surprised myself in seeing the film that Dunn was portrayed in the way that he was. Again, I wasn't there, so I suspect that the both of these things could be true in a way, that the substance of what he was doing, which is to say trying to uphold the reputation of an institution, BC High School in that case, was in fact the case, and also that in the course of the sausage making of making a movie, that the filmmakers kind of intensified the contrasts and intensified the conflicts among the characters. And obviously, if you're one of the protagonists, that is a process that yields a result that is acceptable to you. If you are, ultimately end up looking like somebody who stood in the way of the truth, that's something that will, may even sicken you, as Jack Dunn says it does to him.
And he's suing. Right? I mean,
well, he had a lawyer send a letter asking them to remove the scene from the movie, which mm-hmm. is not likely to happen. But and he said he left open the door that he might sue. On the other hand, the producers of the film have come back and said, well, if you're going to sue us, then we're going to open up this whole family sized can of worms here, and we're going to go back and investigate what exactly did happen, and that could get really ugly. So I'm not sure that's going to happen. But if it were just Jack Dunn, it would be one thing.
There's others who are saying similar things. And one of them that's really interesting to me is someone who was really associated with the whole clergy abuse story at the time. I remember covering it. And that's lawyer Rob McLeish. And he actually defended victims of sex abuse in court. And in the movie, he's portrayed as a lawyer who agreed to confidential settlements in several abuse cases, which was apparently a legal avenue to take at the time. And we do have a clip from the movie with Rachel McAdam, who plays Globe reporter Sasha Pfeiffer, and with Michael Keating, who plays the Globe's Walter Robinson. And here in this clip, they're trying to get information from attorney Eric McLeish. Let's listen.
We understand you've settled several cases against the church.
I can't discuss that.
There aren't any records of any of these settlements.
Nope. We've got two stories here. A story about degenerate clergy, and a story about a bunch of lawyers turning child abuse into a cottage industry. Which story do you want us to write? Because we're writing one of them.
Oof. So that, of course, the trailer from the Spotlight movie. The movie, we should say, does eventually reveal that McLeish did had turned over information to the Globe several years earlier about a potential pattern of abuse on the part of priests. But the Globe didn't do anything with that information, which is something that appears to have haunted Walter Robinson at the time. And also, the Globe then later names McLeish as one of the people who made a difference in the abuse scandal. So let's talk about him as another person who feels wronged by this movie, John.
Well, interestingly, the publisher at the time, Richard Gilman, wrote a piece out for the Arizona Daily Star addressing the sort of accuracies and inaccuracies in the film. And he says in that piece that scene never happened. That encounter never happened. And he also says his complaint is that he was painted as someone who was concerned about how this would affect the business prospects of the Globe, how it would affect the bottom line. He says that conversation never happened either. So I think Eric McLeish essentially has a case because it seems like the overwhelming impression is he set up this cottage industry of secret settlements and was an enabler of the church, as opposed to somebody who was trying to hold the church to account. So I think his complaint has some merit too. And Steve Kirkjian, who is a reporter who was depicted as someone who sort of poo-pooed the investigation and dismissed one of the victims who was giving information to them, he was actually part of the Spotlight team. He was someone who participated in the reporting that won the Pulitzer Prize. So I think that when you take four people and four people say they've been misrepresented, I think that presents a problem and a pattern.
But the movie starts with, I believe...
Based on a true story.
Or based on actual events, I think it says. Is there a difference? What does that mean? You know, I think that there are questions to be raised about that. Is there a lot of talk about this, Dante, in the newsroom? I mean, are folks talking about this and wondering about, you know, why people are coming forward now with these issues?
Don't have a lot of inside information on this and won't pretend to. I think that what's confusing about the movie in a way is that, you know, when it says based on true events, you don't get any kind of delineation of what is true and what has been improvised on the fly. I think one pattern, one thing that you notice in all of these, what people are saying are misrepresentations is that they're all things that kind of propel the plot of the movie forward in very specific ways. And the assertion that Richard Gilman, was concerned about business sort of points out the fact that, you know, this was something that was a risky decision for the paper to make. The fact that Jack Dunn is portrayed as somewhat minimizing the potential impact of this illustrates how there's a lot of people out there, including the reporters who were involved in the investigation, who initially had trouble imagining that the scale of the problem was at that level. You know, McLeish is portrayed as being an obstacle, and there is some sense in which the series of confidential settlements up to that point was an obstacle. So all of these things, I think it does add up to, you know, it adds up to something where there's a dynamic in the creation of the script or in the creation of the movie where the conveniences that are necessary to move the plot in a certain direction end up pushing a little bit of the accuracy away from where it should be.
Well, I think we have just enough time to very briefly talk about our hubbubs, as we call them, the short stories that may not have made it to the top of the newscast, but they caught our attention. Dante? your hubbub for the week?
My hubbub is about Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project. Last year, they're a Somerville craft brewer, and last year they blew the whistle on pay-to-play, which is an illegal process by which beer distributors have to bribe bar owners to carry certain brands of beer. There was a state investigation. One distributor admitted that this was going on. Unfortunately, this story doesn't have a happy ending necessarily. Pretty Things owners Dan and Martha Paquette announced this week that they are closing down without offering much explanation. Nevertheless, I think beer lovers should drink a toast to them for exposing the kind of rent-seeking and favoritism that occur within a tightly regulated industry.
Right. John Carroll.
Mine is that the Boston Phoenix Archive, which has been homeless for quite a while now, is going to Northeastern University. Publisher Stephen Minjinch announced that he was going to donate the archive. And the Phoenix was an alternative newspaper for almost 50 years here in Boston. It presents a very different view of Boston history than any other really media organization. So it's going there. Dan Kennedy, media critic and professor at Northeastern University, had a lot to do with putting the parties together. So I think this is a good thing for preserving a piece of history that could have faded away pretty easily.
All right. John Carroll, a professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior analyst, thanks very much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. This is Radio Boston.